most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Question Reality. I'm your host, Priscilla Leona, and we are coming to you live from Studio City, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now, if this is your first time tuning in, our show will help you question your career reality. This show is for you if you were, are, or might be considering a career in the entertainment industry. Our guests will provide advice and resource information on how and what it takes to successfully pursue a career in show business. Our guests work in various professions of entertainment, so that means that we will definitely have someone on the show sooner or later from a career that you are interested. Now, if you want to check out our past guests, read their bios, listen to their interview instantly, or download one of the shows, go to the LA Talk Radio website. If you're listening to me now, clue, you're already on it. Yay. So if you're listening to us on the iPhone, it's latalkradio.com. You click on the link at the top of the website that says Channel 1. You scroll down, look for the graphic of our show, which is Question Reality, and you click the link. And this will take you directly to our archive page, where you can view the list of our past guests. Now, our shows, again, as I said earlier, were available for download on iTunes under the podcast section, and you just type in Question Reality Radio in the search box. And also, we have now the Droid application, and iPhones and iPhones and Droid. You can tell how technological I am. They just throw a note at me. Tell them we're on Droid. Yeah, okay, that sounds good. Yeah. So if you understand that, download the Droid app. All right. If you want to find out about our future guests, visit the official Question Reality website directly. Go to questionreality.us, not .com, .us. And we are so fortunate that our show has become so popular. We are booked with guests all the way until March. And I am just so appreciative. Everyone has been so supportive, and we've gotten a fan base from all over the world. I get emails from Germany and France and Russia and Cyprus, Greece and Japan and China, and they tell me how much they love the show, and I just thank them so much. And these are all people who want to come to the United States and pursue a career in entertainment. So all of you as guests really, 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 really help our audience, and I want to thank you so much for that. And we have a fantastic guest for you today. And boy, I tell you, we have been wanting to get him on here for a long time, and I know he's one that can verify that he has waited forever to get on this show. His name is Mr. Quinn Coleman, and if you want to check him out, because you know I'm going to go into my advertisements now because I have to pay the bills, so I got to tell you about some stuff. So you might want to check him out now. He is on myspace.com/ Quinn Coleman Productions. That's QUINNCOLEMANPRODUCTIONS. And you can check him out a little bit. But let's go into the fun, exciting stuff that's going on. Let's see. Now, October the 15th through the 17th, it is the Hollywood Expo. Comics icon Stan Lee, astronaut Buzz Aldrin, Star Trek celebs Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, Jonathan Frakes, and Michael Dorn, Andromeda's Kevin Sorbo, Elvira, and over 100 other stars will appear at Hollywood Expo, the pop culture convention for fans and science fiction, fantasy, horror, film, TV, comics, online entertainment, literature, music. This is just huge. It's at the Hilton Universal City, which is Universal Hollywood Drive in here in California. It's Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5:30. Hollywood Expo ticket holders are invited to stay Friday and Saturday nights for special after-hours exclusive screenings hosted by the cast and crew. So that sounds very exciting. And Robin Rowe will be presenting the comics to film panel on Sunday from 12:15 to 1, and Girl Power on Friday, October 15th, 11:30 to 12:15. And check out the price, $30 a day or $70 for the entire weekend. Now, come on, that is a really good price. And Expo is also making a special limited time 2-for-1 ticket offer to Screenplay Lab members. And if you want more information, go to Hollywood Expo, that's XPO.com, HollywoodXPO.com, and check out all the information on how you can attend this. Now, Digital Hollywood is coming up October the 18th through the 21st, and this will be presenting top executives in film, television, music, home video, cable, and telecommunications. And again, Robin Rowe is going to be presenting a panel on Thursday at 2:15 to 3:30. And it's monetizing original media, broadband, viral, episodic programming, content and advertising. And Patrick Bardwell, who's the founder and president of, it's called Slubisodes, Slubisodes Web Series Guide. Josh Spector, Senior VP of Content and Marketing, Comedy.com. Jason Peterson, founder and president of Go Digital. Nathan Anderson, Managing Director. Envelope Entertainment Australia, Burns Holliman, President and CEO of the Digital Entertainment Alliance, Joe Ferreira, Senior VP, Network and Studio Liaison, CBS Interactive, Christopher Kubasik, Creator, The Booth, Todd Green, Digital Media Guru, former head MPRM Digital, at the Lowe's Santa Monica Beach Hotel. Now, this is a little bit pricey, so start saving $495 to $785. But to see all of those people and get an opportunity to network and schmooze, I think it's worth it. So that you might want to make that your Christmas present. The website is digitalhollywood.com, digitalhollywood.com to check that out. Now, October 23rd to the 27th, we have Adobe Max Conference, the Adobe Max Conference. And there you can connect with thousands of designers and developers and business leaders that are shaping the future of digital media. Because you know, digital media, we are surrounded by it. It's not going away, old people. So old people, you got to start going. I'm getting to be an old person myself, so I'll put myself in that category. But you got to start going to these conferences. You got to keep up with this stuff. And you can discover the full potential of your content and applications and just learn more about them. And you can explore new methods for monetizing content, which is great. You're also going to learn innovative technologies that enable designers and developers to work together more effectively. And that's going to be at the Los Angeles Convention Center, and that is at 1201 South Figueroa Street and Nokia Theater, 777 Chick Hearn Court, Los Angeles, California. Now, that is the price of a used car in Kentucky. That would be $1,495. If you want to find out more about that, the website is max.adobe.com. And lastly, November the 2nd, it's the DEG BlueCon Conference. DEG BlueCon Conference is presented by the Digital Entertainment Group, and the keynote is Avatar director James Cameron and producer John Landau, and they're going to be discussing 3D. And the BDA, which is the Blu-ray Disc Association, will be presenting a 3D Blu-ray pavilion featuring the latest home entertainment 3D technologies from Panasonic, Samsung, Sony, Technicolor, and Intel. And that's going to be at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles, $395, which sounds like a deal. Blu-con.com, blu-con.com. And you can find out all the information. So get that purse and open the strings and get some money out, because you got to start going to these things. I cannot emphasize how you need to get out there and market and network and schmooze, because that's how all the deals are done. And I guarantee you that Mr. Quinn Coleman probably knows everybody that I was just talking about, and we're going to ask him about that. Now, let me tell you, he's laughing because he knows. He is such a big wig. He's such a big firecracker, and I'm so glad that we have him on the show today, because he's going to give all of you guys wonderful advice. Mr. Quinn Coleman is an accomplished entertainment professional with a proven record of achievement in negotiating and strategically guiding the acquisition and development of over 200 live action and animated feature and television films, generating gross revenues in excess of $400 million. The numbers are just too much. I'm glazing over right now. I can't even think about somebody dealing with those numbers. I don't even know.
Salary were only that high.
I know. Through the years, he's worked at such companies such as 20th Century Fox, Turner Broadcasting, Disney, NBC, Regent Media, and Warner Brothers. And you say, how did little Mr. Quinn Coleman get to be such a powerhouse? Well, he began his career as a child performer. So there is hope for all of your kids to become as big as Mr. Coleman. He was a child performer, leading to the singing and the writing and the producing of several singles on major labels in the United States, MCA, Curb, and Japan, which is Phonogram. And Mr. Quinn has appeared on TV shows from America's MTV to Japan's Ohayo studio, and been interviewed for multiple magazines, newspapers, and radio programs. He's performed as the opening act for such artists as John Ford Coley, Laura Branigan, Gloria, I can't sing, as you know, but love that song. Corey Hart, I Wear My Sunglasses at Night. I'm having a whole 80s moment here, because everybody knows I love my 80s music. And Rick Springfield, oh my God, I wish I had Jesse's Girl. I was just watching a repeat episode of Glee, and it just takes you back. It takes you back. We love Rick Springfield, so we are going to have to find out some scoops on him if he's as hot as he looks. And he also wrote and performed internationally, released music under the tutelage of Grammy Award winning producer Michael Lloyd. Now, we know how big Michael Lloyd is, and if you don't, you shouldn't be listening to my program. Go to McDonald's, get a cheeseburger. Go to New Jersey, and maybe you could possibly hang out with people from Jersey Shore. If you don't know who Michael Lloyd is, you shouldn't be listening. Quinn he earned an MBA from UCLA Anderson School of Management with an emphasis in entertainment business. And subsequent opportunities enabled him to attain a broad knowledge and understanding of the – are you ready for this? We're going to be learning a little bit about acquisition, distribution, marketing, and development of various entertainment media. Most artists, if I even said these words, that's it. They'd be in a coma by now. They would say, I gotta go, I'll see you later. That's the business. What he does is what keeps the cogs turning for you to be able to play your guitar and stay up all night and drive me crazy. Okay, so he prepared film and syndication licensing agreement. He helped formulate a distribution strategy for NBC TV to optimize his position and profits in the syndication marketplace. He devised innovative methods for synthesizing acquisitions data into meaningful reports for optimum decision making. He actively participated in film festivals such as Sundance, woo, Berlin, Cannes, and Toronto, my God, and developed, negotiated, and acquired rights to motion pictures throughout the world. While at Warner Brothers, he secured such hits as My Dog Skip, one of my favorite movies, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and A Cinderella Story. And as VP of Acquisition at Regent Media, he was instrumental in licensing the 2009 Oscar-winning foreign film Departures from Japan. And as if the man has not lived 100 lives in this lifetime, recently, Mr. Quinn has found success as the co-writer, producer, and remixer with DJs the Perry Twins on several number one Billboard dance hits for singers such as Jennifer Lopez, Christine W., Nikki Harris, and Aaron Hamilton. I'm surprised the man's still living, personally. I just honestly, all of this, I think I'm out of breath just reading it. Imagine him. He lived it. Are you still alive, Quinn Coleman?
No, I'm dead now just listening to that introduction.
I know! When you hear it, it's, I mean, don't you start thinking, my God, I'm the whip.
Oh, yes. I just think I'm the bomb.
Don't you start thinking, my God, I'm impressive. I need to look in a mirror. Hold on, Priscilla. I'm going
no,
to
I don't
look
want to scare,
right
I don't
now.
Want to scare myself. I do not want to scare myself during your show.
Oh, I don't even think so, because I got a picture of you, and it went out in the press package, and I've been getting emails like, wow, he's a hottie. Is he single? So don't be that. You're too modest, Quinn Coleman.
Well, you're very sweet.
I got to tell you, it's amazing. Now, here's what I always start with. This is my standard question, because this is what most people want to know. You're at the point that you are now, but what did you want to do or be when you were a child? What did Quinn Coleman want to be?
I used to sit in my room. Now, I'm going to really age myself here, but I used to sit in my room. I had headphones on. I'm 8 years old. I'm listening to Funny Girl. I'm listening to Barbra Streisand sing. And I remember thinking, what an incredible voice. This person has this amazing talent. And I got into music by the Carpenters and others. And I would sit in my room and I would visualize this. And I was 5 years old, by the way, when I first went on stage at a church function. And after the show was over, I wouldn't come off the stage. I don't remember this, but my mother relates the story to me and tells me that she came up to me and she said, why won't you come down off the stage? And I said, because I like it up here. So when I was 8 years old, they drove me down to the Little Theater of Alexandria. This was right after Oliver had been on Broadway. And this little theater in Washington, D.C. used to get all of these shows that, you know, were pretty much fresh off of Broadway. So I went to audition for Oliver, and I didn't get the role, but they called me back, and they said, we want your son, or they called my parents back and said, we want your son to be in the chorus. And in the process of being in the chorus, they said, you know, we really want him to be Oliver's understudy. So I understudied for Oliver a couple times during the run of the show, and from that point forward, started having this little theater kind of career happen in Washington, D.C. So initially, to answer your question, I thought I was going to be a star. I thought I was going to be a Broadway singer or an actor or something like that.
Right.
And when I got in my teens and my voice changed, I mean, I looked like I was, you know, 8 years old when I was 14. And so, but I'm singing, you know, with this completely different voice, so I couldn't play the kid roles anymore in any of these shows. So I started recording, and I hooked up with a record producer who I had seen him in Las Vegas. He was the musical producer for the Osmonds, a guy named H.B. Barnum.
Oh,
and
God.
Nothing related to the circus, but H.B. was one of the original people that was involved in creating the Motown sound. He was arranging at that time for people like Aretha Franklin and others, and he was just the coolest guy. And so I saw his name on the back of an Osmond record after I'd seen him in Vegas doing their show. And I said, I called him, and you know, I think I was about 16 at this point, and my dad hired him, and he produced 4 songs for me and released them on his record label. I did this was in the disco era, 1975 or 6, somewhere around there. We released a remake of an old song called The More I See You.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought on his Little Star Records. Interestingly enough, Peter Allen, who was married to Liza Minnelli and wrote the song I Honestly Love You for Lavinia and John and some other great songs, he released a pop version of the exact song right as we were releasing ours. And of course, he's on A&M Records and I'm on Little Star Records, which is nothing. But it was a great experience, and that's kind of how I started, you know, moving really more into the professional side. So to answer your question in a nutshell, I thought I was going to be a star. There was no way I was not going to be a singing star. My walls in my bedroom were plastered. I had every picture of Donnie and Marie that you could possibly find.
God, I love it!
Covering
yes.
my walls. Everywhere.
Me too.
My parents had to repaint the room because there was so much sticky tape everywhere from all the pictures.
Oh, honey,
that were
you don't
taken down.
No, I was so in love with him. I cried for a month when he married Debbie. I cried. I got to go backstage. My cousin, I have a picture of him in his purple hat because you know he loved purple. Right?
Oh, yeah, the purple socks.
Yes, right. So I got to go backstage, a little tiny thing, and I got to take a little picture of him, and I have a picture of him, and I saw him. But it was like I was in a daze because I just couldn't believe that it was him. And my cousin whipped me because she was dating one of the bouncers, and they got me backstage. And I don't know what she had to do to get that. But I was only there a second. I'm like, Donnie, as I'm being pulled away out of the door and thrown in the car. And I got my little picture, but I still to this day have it. Love Donny Osmond. Could not stand it. I mean, I know
when,
what you
when
mean.
When you talk about marrying Debbie, just so you, I mean, to maybe make the story just for you possibly a little more interesting, Donnie and Marie, I became very good friends with when I went to Brigham Young University to go out there to go to school, and they owned an apartment complex called the Riviera Apartments, and they lived in the main building of the complex, and all of us had apartments, of course. And we became really good friends. In fact, we double dated a couple times. Sonny and me and Debbie and Marie's best friend and I were
dating.
No!
Oh my
and
God!
So we drove, Paula will probably not appreciate me telling this story on the radio, but we drove their cars down for them to Las Vegas when they opened at the Hilton the week that Donnie married Debbie. And they had this huge reception up on the top floor at that Hilton at the time was the hotel in Vegas. And they were staying in that suite on the, you know, on the very top floor of the hotel. So we went in there for Donnie and Debbie's reception. And of course it was a big deal because they were doing their show and they had, all I remember is the best food I've ever had at a reception.
Oh my God. So
but if you remember those two kind of ran off and got married and
yes.
if you remember and
yes,
nobody
I do.
Really knew about it.
Yes, I do, and I changed to Sean Cassidy. I said, damn you, after I wiped my tears away. I said, that's it. I am moving on to Sean Cassidy. So then I became fixated on him until I went to the concert.
He did what?
Remember he went to the – he was performing – I don't know if you heard about it. I'm sure you did. But remember when Sean Cassidy was at the concert and he bent over doing the Hey Deanie song and he split his red satin pants on stage? Do you remember that?
I remember
that was
hearing
all over
about
TV?
That, yeah.
Yep. I was at that concert. Yep. Yeah, after that, he turned me off. I moved on to Tony DeFranco.
Oh, no. Well, my record producer, the guy that eventually became my, you know, my biggest, you know, shot at the big time was a guy named Michael Lloyd, who was business partners with Mike Curb. And they produced Osmonds and Sean Cassidy and Leif Garrett and Debbie Boone and all those guys. And so it was kind of interesting how, you know, once you got into that teen world, it was, you know, that was my biggest shot at making it at that point. That's a long story, but
so you're hanging out. out with all these teen heartthrobs. I'm assuming you're around.
No. I was not hanging out with those guys. They were just on the same, or they were being produced by the same people that I was eventually produced by.
So they didn't get you guys together and do like press junkets back then with a whole bunch of you like they do today, you know, to have all the artists.
How was it different back then? Well, it was different. MTV was just kind of coming into its own at that point. It was actually a station that revolved around music, very different than it is today. And this was after I had gone to Japan and I had a record contract in Japan, which is a whole other discussion. But when I came back to the U.S., I was in a band called Souvenir, and we were signed by Mike Curb, and Michael Lloyd was our record producer. And this was sometime in 82 or 83. And back then, you know, we were doing a lot of singles and trying to figure out which song would be the song that would work and doing some videos. And wow, that was a big deal to be on MTV at that point. That was kind of the thing. But the record industry was starting to change even at that point. You had to kind of, record labels weren't necessarily going in and breaking you anymore. You had to be somewhat established somewhere. It was just, we were on the cusp of things kind of changing. You needed a movie theme, or you needed some television show, anything. And in fact, our record producer had done a couple films that he put us in, one called Love Lines, another one called Tomboy, little independent films that were not big hits. And I think we were signed with Curb for maybe 5-6 years. And I asked at one point to get out of the contract because I just felt like I needed to be out of the band, do my own thing. You know, a year later, Michael Lloyd was scrambling to find enough songs for a little soundtrack that he was doing for another one of his small films.
Right.
He could only get 10 songs for that soundtrack, and we would have been on that soundtrack if I hadn't gotten out of the contract. And 50 million copies later, Dirty Dancing remains the biggest
soundtrack of all time.
You kind of miss those moments every now and then, and that was my it's a good thing I don't use an electric razor, or it is a good thing I use an electric razor, because I wouldn't be here today, I should say.
I hear you.
It's just one of those moments that you think back on, you go, oh, my gosh, did I miss that train? But, you know, I guess things work out the way they're supposed to.
That's right. Now you were opening for such artists like John Ford Coley, Laura Branigan, Corey Hart, and Rick Springfield. How was that? I mean, I assume that we hadn't actually talked about the type of music that you were singing, but I assumed it fell into the same category. So like pop music.
We were kind of a little bit more, I mean, I was a really soft ballad, pretty quote unquote singer. I mean, I wanted to be the male Karen Carpenter. I wanted to be, you know, also my hair was not quite as lovely as hers was back in those days. But if you remember that great hair she used to have. She's my favorite. I love her as a singer, but the hair needed to go. But that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be this really, you know, I wanted to have one hit ballad after another. Curb signed us on the strength of a couple songs that I had written in our band, and they were a little bit more on kind of the pop rock side. But even then, the labels said when they shopped us around, because Curb is always distributed, you know, by other labels. He was with MCA Universal for a long time now. I believe that Curb is distributed through Warner Brothers. And they're a big country label primarily right now. But anyway, when they heard my voice, they thought, yeah, very pretty. But this was a time when Flock of Seagulls and all sorts of different
R.E.M., Depeche Mode, Water.
All those guys were becoming big hits, and they thought our sound was a little soft with my voice. They married us with another guy that was on Curb, who, of all things, also happened to live. I was living in, you know, up there in Provo, Utah, and this guy lived in Provo, Utah also, and he was this big Freddie Mercury kind of phenomenal rock voice. So they thought, let's create a little bit harder Air Supply kind of group. And a lot of your listeners won't even know who that is. But for those, for my generation, Air Supply was huge.
Oh yeah.
But they were, you know, a little softer. They wanted us to do just a little harder edged Air Supply kind of thing where the two of us played off of each other and sang a little different styles. So we tried that, and we produced record after record after record, and Billboard would say, "Oh, this record sounds like a hit," and blah blah blah. We never had a hit. It's all about timing.
It really is. It's all about timing, and you just never know when you could go your whole life being prepared, and you never get the opportunity. And then some people get the opportunity and they're not prepared. So it really
is. Well, an important I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you don't. You just don't know. I was going to ask you, since you've been in, because many people say, what is the secret for a young person who's considering a career in entertainment? They often say, what's the best way for a musical artist to go viral and get noticed by the right people? What's the secret? What would you say that is?
Well, first of all, I think an artist has to be really, truly artistic people. Already have an innate sense of who they are, what their style is, what they should look like, what they should sound like, what kind of music they do. Some people can help you hone that and craft that, but there are those singers who are manufactured and created, but true artists, and I'm not saying that I am a true artist, but I think I had an artist soul. I knew who I was. I knew what my sound was like. I would have been better off, for instance, staying very true to what I was naturally good at, not trying to get into some rock thing or whatever that wasn't really natural to me. So my first piece of advice to anyone is figure out what you're good at and stay true to that. Secondly, you better understand the business side of this pretty well. Doesn't mean you have to go out and get an MBA like I did. But I can guarantee you that the most successful artists out there know the business. Doesn't mean they're business people per se, but I guess in a way you could call them business people. If you want to have a career that lasts longer than one or two records, at least in the music field, you had better understand the business. Mike Curb told me in 1983, he said, Quinn, the music business is 95% business and 5% music. And I remember rejecting that concept out of hand, just thinking that's ridiculous. But when you think about it, it's called show business. It's the music business. It's not music art. If you want to do art, terrific. If that's all you want to do, terrific. But if you want to make any money, you want to have a career, you better understand the business and understand that it's driven by business.
So, absolutely. Bottom line, bottom dollar. There's no secret at all.
So you've got to be as prepared musically as you could possibly ever be, have a really good sense of self. Be very good at what you do. Doesn't mean that you have to be a great singer. There's so many people that aren't great singers who are the biggest stars in the world. But you just got to have a musical sense of what works for you, what's hip, what's commercial, have kind of a visionary, have an ability to envision, I should say, what's next, what's ahead. Combine that with some business savvy, and you'll have a much better chance. I wasn't really prepared when I look back in some ways. It always kind of came easy for me. I was a really, if I may say so, I was a really good child singer. And when you're a kid and you can sing, if you remember like Andrea McArdle from Annie, that huge big voice, if you have that kind of a voice as a child, people are like, wow, that's impressive. When you become, a late teen or early, you get into your early 20s, there are a lot of people who can sing like that. You're not unique anymore.
Right.
So in some ways, it came so easy for me that I didn't, when I look back on it, I don't think that I put a lot of those pieces of the puzzle together, the artistry, the business, all of that, in a way that I think would have kept me in there a little bit longer, given me a little bit better shot. So the advice to anyone trying to do that would really be, you've really got to be prepared, and there's so many ways you can do that now.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many educational avenues from like Berklee College of Music to, all these schools here in Hollywood. I mean, there's just so many places online that you can get the information. There's a plethora, a wealth of knowledge that everyone should avail themselves of.
Now, let me ask you, people always ask, how good does my song have to be before I send it out? And I think what they really should be asking is, how good does my demo have to be? Because now, of course, they want to hear more than one song. So what would your answer be to that?
Demos, if a demo doesn't sound like a record, I think you're kind of, a demo really needs to sound like a record. Today you can make a record. I mean, we're producing, you know, in no way to sound arrogant, we're producing number one Billboard dance record just sitting here in the house. You know, we go do vocals in a professional studio, but we remix, we do everything here in a home studio. Now it's a little more elaborate than just a computer, but at the same time, it's a home studio. But if those records don't sound like records, we can't compete. Even if it's a demo, I think you have to be able to compete with records. Now, you're probably not going to get, unless you're working with professional engineers or whatever, you're not going to get record quality sounding demos unless you yourself are, like I say, either working with someone who knows how to do that or you have that ability yourself. But beyond the sound of a record, a hit song is a hit song, whether it's played with a guitar, whether it's a piano, whether it's, you know, you singing to a ukulele. I mean, you can recognize a hit song or not. If a song's a hit and you have a unique voice, that's actually going to trump a great sounding demo any day. Although you do kind of handicap yourself if you don't have a great demo, because so many people now have great demos. It's like trying to pitch a screenplay idea without a script. It's done all the time, but it tends to be a little better if you have a script because so many people already have their scripts done. So
exactly. But it's like so many musicians, I mean, let's be honest, they're kind, you know, they're poor. They're barely struggling to make ends meet, and they don't really have much money to go to these record producers or people who have recording studios and spend $5,000 for a demo, and it's not even guaranteed anything's going to happen with it. What do you say to those people? How can it be, you know, less expensive? What can they do to make it sound good, but not have to spend all that money?
Well, I think you can do that. You know, sometimes it's pulling favors. Sometimes it's just networking and meeting people who will work with you for free with the, you know, maybe you're a songwriter and you have to cut them a bit of a publishing deal if the music works in exchange for putting together demos for you or whatever. But as I said before, it's all about the song, just like in the film business, it's all about the story. I mean, it's all about the script. So if you don't have a great song, it doesn't really matter what you can have the most. I hear some of the most beautifully produced records, and these records are not hit songs.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how well the demo's produced, how well the actual production of the final record is produced. If it's not a hit song, it doesn't matter anyway. So if someone is really truly gifted and they've got great songwriting ability, or they have a great song and they're a very unique sounding singer, whatever combination it is, I would still be impressed myself by hearing just one single instrument and a terrific song and a terrific singer is going to blow you away.
Right.
Far more than a great production and an average song. So I'm not sure it really matters to a certain degree.
Exactly, because sometimes they overproduce the music, and then people just don't even want to hear it. The record executives are like, oh, I don't want to hear that. So let me ask you,
can I just say one thing before you go on?
Yeah.
Real quickly there, though. In today's world, record companies are acting a lot more like distributors than ever before. Much like the movie studios, and I've worked in both fields, the movie studios really pretty much, I mean, they make a lot of their movies, but they're also just massive distributors of product. And, you know, record companies are losing their shirts because everyone's illegally downloading and whatnot. So they're not spending the kind of money to develop artists the way they used to. A lot of artists are coming to them with fully made, you know, demos that are records, and those things get released as is. So, you know, there's so many different ways to skin that cat, but you got to keep in mind that record companies aren't necessarily, unless you are just brilliant beyond belief, it's a lot harder to get a record company to take you from scratch and fund everything at this point because the upside for them is not as great anymore.
Absolutely. It just takes too long. They don't do any developing stars anymore like they used to. I understand.
Not the way
that
they used to.
Absolutely not. So let me ask you, it's hard enough to make the actual demo or song. What do you feel are the characteristic traits that you should have, that one person should have in order to become successful in the entertainment business, whether it's in music or on the business side of things in acting, you know, dancing? What do you feel the characteristic traits, what are the characteristic traits? Because a lot of people feel that they can do it. They're like, I know I can do it. But then they may not have the ability to organize. They may not have the ability to focus. They may not have. What do you feel are the necessary characteristic traits? If you don't have them, we might have a problem.
Well, belief in yourself, which may sound really trite, was something, interestingly enough, H.B. Barnum told me when I was 16, he said, when you stop believing that you can actually do this, you'll probably never get back to that point again where you do believe you can, which I didn't really understand what he was saying at the time. But when I did start doubting myself in my, my late 20s as to whether I could really pull it off or not, it was never the same after that. Once that courage was, now, it doesn't mean I couldn't have gotten it back, but I understood at that point what he was talking about. I had never had any doubt. I think that I had heard recently on the radio that mathematicians and musicians and people of certain ilks know from a very early time in their lives what they want to do, and there's nothing else they want to do. Once I had been on stage, I knew that entertainment was all that I ever wanted to do. So my whole life, whether I've made money at it or not, during the good times, during the lean times, whatever, I have never wanted to do anything other than something related in a major way to entertainment. So if you don't have that kind of passion, for instance, I was in business school and I was the head of the Entertainment Business Association at Anderson at UCLA, and I had a couple people come up to me at different points and say, I'm thinking of using, I'm majoring or emphasizing accounting or whatever, and I'm thinking of doing it at a studio. What do you think? And my feeling was, unless you're really, really, really passionate in that instance, for instance, in getting involved in entertainment or being in entertainment, I would do something else. It's too cutthroat. It's too difficult. There's too much not that other fields are not competitive, but the entertainment field is particularly vicious. It's particularly difficult, I think, to succeed in, to find longevity, to find mentors, to find stability, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the traits you have to have is this intense passion to do it. You've got to be genuinely talented, especially if you're on the artistic side of things. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
If you want to be an artist of some kind, if you intrinsically don't have the talent, don't do it. Now, a lot of people will tell you don't have the talent to do it. They told Enrique Caruso, they told, Karen Carpenter, they told all these people they'd never be stars, their voices weren't right, blah, blah, blah. You hear these stories all the time. And they became massive stars. But there comes a point where someone who you trust, someone has got to evaluate you at some point and say, you've got it, you don't have it. It's interesting to watch American Idol and someone as blunt as Simon Cowell, who I think is right more often than he's wrong. He evaluates talent and he says, I don't think you have it, or I think you have it. Someone like that at some point in your life has to say, wow, you're amazing, or something, you might be better off becoming a recording engineer, or maybe you're a great songwriter, but the singing ain't so good, or you don't write great songs, but you're a terrific singer, or whatever it is. But someone's really got to evaluate you and at some point give you an honest feedback, someone you trust, someone that, you know what I'm saying? And
absolutely.
Now maybe that's a collection of different people.
Right. And you've got to be willing to accept constructive criticism. A lot of artists are sensitive and they don't want to hear it, because if you really think you're talented, and I know people who think they are the bee's knees and they are just one
horrible.
Step away, and
they're
wrong. They are wrong. They are like wrong. They start singing. I just and they really think they can sing. It's just, Quinn, you are going to die because you're not going to believe what time it is. It is 5:44, and I am so upset because I have 12 more questions. And I am so upset right now. I cannot even tell you, because you are a person who is just you have an infinite amount of wisdom and advice. And I think that we are going to have to break this up into a 4-part Quinn Coleman series.
Oh, right. I'm sorry I talked too much. I apologize for rambling on and on.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying I'm going to beg you, plead, and whip out my piggy bank to bribe you to come back on again, because you have so much wisdom, and I would like beg you to come back on maybe next year and maybe follow up and give some more advice. Would you be willing to do that?
Oh, I'd love to. Sure.
I mean, you've got so much to offer, and I
but
think
without
that,
the piggy bank, I'm not sure.
I know. I'm gonna. Hey, well, Christmas is coming up. I'm gonna save all my pennies just for you, Quinn Coleman.
Okay.
But you have to realize that you are just such a blessed man, in that you have such wisdom and knowledge, and you have such experience, and you have so many things that people would just die for, kill for. They would just sell their mother to have the experience and knowledge that you have. And for you to be generous by coming on the show today, I really appreciate it, and I'm sure everybody else does. And I'm sure that people are upset that we're not going to ask a lot of the questions, because I did get emails, and that was the latter part of the show was going to be dedicated to that. So I did want to apologize to everybody and ask Mr. Quinn Coleman to commit now to come back next year and answer all of your emails. Can I get a commitment?
Oh, of course. I would love to come back. You're wonderful.
Okay. So questions 10 through 17 will be dedicated to the emails that I got, because we just can't cover it now. But you know why? Because I want to get that CD that you sent played. Now, tell us, we're going to listen to that right now. Tell us real quick, because we got 3 minutes.
Okay, just real quick.
What is that?
The Perry Twins, who are these brilliant young DJs, and I finished writing and producing a song for a singer named Abigail, who's had several hit dance songs. And this is basically going to what they call dance radio. And so this was designed for dance radio, and we just finished it. And you're one of the first audiences, in fact, other than maybe a mix show that it was premiered on. I think this is probably the first quote unquote regular audience that's heard the song. So it's going to dance radio sometime here in the next month.
So this, the band is, the singer is called, her name?
Her name is Abigail.
Abigail.
And in the dance world, the way it's billed is the Perry Twins featuring Abigail.
Okay.
And the Perry Twins and I sat down, and we wrote the song and produced the song and played all the instruments together, and we created the song. And all of it was done here in the studio here in the house, except for the vocal, which was done, of course, in a professional studio. So this is... This will give you an idea of what you can do. You can do so much more than what we do, but I mean, it just gives you a little bit of an idea of what you can do working just even in a home studio.
Okay.
The song's called We'll Never Know.
We'll Never Know. All right. And this is, if they want to find out more, they can go to your website, which is the MySpace, myspace.com.
Well, I don't actually use that much. The best place to go to find out the latest information about the music would be theperrytwins.com.
The Perry Twins. P-E-R-R-Y-T-W-I-N-S, perrytwins.com website.
Really good looking young guys who are incredibly talented. They just performed last night in West Hollywood.
Well, let's hear them. Let's end the show. We got 1 minute. We're going to hear them. We got 1 minute, and then we're going to get cut off. But I just wanted to thank you so much. God bless you.
No, thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks everybody for listening. And I'm going to contact you later on in the year, and we'll get you set up for next week. Thanks for listening. We're going to now listen to the Perry Twins.
Bye-bye.
I was lost when I found you. I still don't know where to go. Can't switch directions, I feel like I change too slow. The lights are so blinding, the feelings too dark. Your fears are blinding, I'm still stuck.
listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.